Welcome to Hand Therapy Heroes, the premier podcast on hand and upper extremity rehabilitation. As a worldwide educator and developer of best-in-class hand therapy content, Susan Weiss, occupational therapist and certified hand therapist, brings you an array of hand therapy specialists, hand care solutions, and more.
Welcome, everyone, to Hand Therapy Heroes. Thank you so much for joining us. And for those of you who did not hear our last episode, we highly recommend listening to that before this episode, as it is a brilliant precursor and introduction to the amazing hero that we have here sharing with us during this session. Our hand therapy hero is Dr. Eaton, and he's going to share with us his thoughts on current practices for Dupuytren's disease, as well as provide insights that will be valuable on a ton of levels for you in your current practice. So Dr. Eaton, what are the best available clinical practices available for Dupuytren, since as of this discussion, we have no cure?
I wish I had a simple answer for that, but there are a lot of factors that all mix together. So the goal of treating Dupuytren, the big picture, is to, and this is actually, sadly, a very low bar, to minimize the number of permanent complications that someone has over the course of their lifetime of treatment. And that's really the big picture, because the current model of treatment is that you wait for a finger to become bent, and then you do some procedure to make it less bent, and then you wait for that to start again, and you keep repeating that until the patient gets tired of it, or there's a major complication and scares everybody off, or the surgeon says there's nothing else we can do, or the finger stops and doesn't continue bending. And of all of those things, obviously the best outcome is the last one, but we don't have good data on how common that is or whether that's even an achievable goal, because a lot of people are off the radar with Dupuytren. So with that as the background, we have a couple options. And so there are two main categories of treatment of Dupuytren contracture. Right now, there's not a proven preventive treatment, and because of the numbers that I discussed earlier, there's not even a good way to test preventive treatments. There are a lot of potential preventive treatments, but without a blood test, there's not a practical way to test them. So the two main physical treatments of Dupuytren are open surgery and minimally invasive procedures. So the most common way that Dupuytren is treated is with open surgery and with a procedure called fasciectomy, in which the skin surgeon opens up the skin and finds the tissue that looks visibly different, affected by Dupuytren, and removes that. And in the process, that helps the finger straighten out, and then everything heals up. And has been a standard kind of procedure for almost 180 years. There are a lot of different variations on it, where to put the incisions and whether you should do a bigger or a smaller operation. And there's a lot of discussion about those, but I think they all fall into the old saying that if a problem has many solutions, either all of them work or none of them work. And unfortunately, I think this is something in the latter category. Mm-hmm. But most people who have the open surgery, a fasciectomy, do well. The difficulty with it is that it has a relatively high complication rate, relatively high permanent complication rate. And most studies would put that at around 4%. The numbers are all over the place, but that is a higher likelihood of having a permanent complication than most other elective hand operations of similar magnitude. I mean, that's dramatically higher than trigger finger release or carpal tunnel release or even basal joint arthroplasty. And so the problem is that every time you re-treat you have the same risk or a higher risk of a complication. And so over time, if people are treated successfully and then retreated and then retreated, the likelihood of having a permanent complication is cumulative. And that often is what stops people from coming back for yet another treatment. Now, dermofasciectomy is like fasciectomy. The main difference is that in addition to removing the diseased area of tissues under the skin, certain areas of skin are removed as well. Mm-hmm. And these are typically in kind of wide areas where the Dupuytren really affects people, and around the area of the distal palmar crease, you can take out a section of skin here and replace it with a skin graft, or this whole section on the pulp space over the proximal phalanx, or even the proximal and middle phalanx to be removed and replaced with a skin graft. A dermofasciectomy is not a fasciectomy plus a skin graft. You have to have an excision of a fair bit of tissue, and it's actually called a functional unit. You remove a whole section, usually from midline lateral all the way over to midline lateral. And that, when it's done that way, the chance of having recurrence is lower than with a traditional fasciectomy. The problem in the literature is that people don't always distinguish between a proper dermofasciectomy and just doing a fasciectomy plus putting a skin graft in, or taking out a little bit of skin here, or dropping a skin graft in when the skin is too tight to be able to sew the skin edges back together. Mm-hmm. Those aren't dermofasciectomy, and small skin grafts like that don't improve the long-term control. They don't reduce the recurrence rate. So the advantage of fasciectomy, and even more so for dermofasciectomy, is that it lasts the longest compared to other treatment options. The disadvantage is that it has a fairly high complication rate. And the other group of treatments are minimally invasive. And with these, no tissue is removed. There are two versions of minimally invasive treatments. One is in which the cord is mechanically cut, and the other is where the cord is chemically softened and weakened. And when the cord is cut or chemically weakened, then the surgeon can pull on the finger and stretch out the tissues and regain extension of the finger. So the most common minimally invasive procedure currently is collagenase injection. In the States, that's XIAFLEX. In Europe, it's XIAPEX. And that is a very well-studied treatment in which the person gets a shot into the cord in an area where the cord really can be felt well and is clearly tethering the joint. And then the collagenase enzyme dissolves collagen, which is the main protein that cords are made of. It's let to soak in for a day or a few days, and then the person comes back to the doctor. The doc numbs up the hand, pulls on the finger, and the cord rips under the skin and allows the finger to straighten out. The next most common minimally invasive treatment is the one that I had a lot of experience with, which is percutaneous fasciotomy or needle aponeurotomy. And with this, the cord is cut under the skin, but it's cut, instead of using a scalpel, the surgeon uses a little hypodermic needle, because the tip of a hypodermic needle has two little cutting edges on it. It's not a smooth conical tip like a sewing needle. And anybody who's worked with needles to some extent may have had a situation in which the needle grazed across their finger and cut just like a scalpel. And so you can use that effect to numb up the skin, not numb up the tissues under the skin. The surgeon can poke a small needle through the numbed spot on the skin, feel the cord with the tip of the needle, and graze across or pierce through the cord enough that it weakens it. And then they can pull on the finger and straighten the finger out. And the advantage of these minimally invasive procedures is that it's much less of an ordeal for the patient. So rather than having possibly a few months of post-op recovery as you would after surgery, it can be a matter of days. The ordeal of minimally invasive procedures is much less than for open surgery, fasciectomy. And what I mean by that is that the traditional open surgery is done typically in an operating room as an outpatient setting, and the minimally invasive procedures are office procedures. So the whole ordeal of checking to the hospital for surgery and having to go through all the hoops that you have to for that is not there for the minimally invasive procedures. And in addition to that, when someone has the regular open surgery for Dupuytren, one of the problems is that the biology of Dupuytren is similar to that of wound healing. And so when you make big cuts in the palm right in the area where the Dupuytren biology is active, that sometimes sets it off. And at the very least, it takes a while to recover from the surgery to have the wounds healed up. And that's typically 6 weeks, but if you're not lucky, it can go on for months with just a smoldering inflammation, swelling, stiffness, pain, difficulty, and things that people like to complain about because they're interfering with their lives. And so that's part of the ordeal of making it through it. Comparing the two, fasciectomy has a higher risk of having a permanent complication, and that risk varies depending on who you've read, but a reasonable ballpark is somewhere between 4% and 5% risk of having some lingering complication, not just bruising, but problems with feeling in the finger, problems with stiffness, problems making a fist afterward, because stiffness is not just lack of ability to straighten the fingers, is also a lack of ability to bend the fingers. And that can be an even bigger nuisance. A common kind of problem after surgery is cold intolerance. That is, people whose hands are exposed to cold weather, or even if it's just cold ambient temperature, people may have changes in the circulation of their fingers with pain, numbness, stiffness, color changes. It can be fairly dramatic. It's not as big a deal if you live in warm climates, but most people don't live in warm climates, and it can be quite an issue. That relationship to surgery and the relationship to Dupuytren hasn't really been worked out. There is some anecdotal evidence that Dupuytren itself might be associated with cold intolerance, but there's not been a study done on that. It certainly is an issue which is more likely after regular open surgery and may be increased after minimally invasive procedures, but we don't have any firm numbers on that. The cost of treatment really shouldn't figure in, but it does. And so the most expensive treatment to have once is the open surgery. Xiaflex has been priced to be similar to open surgery, so it's a little bit less expensive. Needle laparotomy or percutaneous fasciotomy is much less expensive. And so from that perspective, needle fasciotomy is the most economical treatment. The next way to look at it is to take into account the fact that there are recurrences. And so there's a study that came out recently that looked at the 5-year costs, taking into account the fact that people that have minimal procedures are likely to have recurrences within the first 5 years and afterward. And so if you add up the cumulative cost of treatments over the course of 5 years, the people that have open surgery have a low likelihood of needing to have a second procedure, but people who have minimally invasive procedures are fairly likely to have a repeat treatment. And so because Xiaflex is more expensive than needle laparotomy, even if there are multiple procedures, the needle laparotomy is a cheaper cumulative cost. And in this study, the collagenase treatment actually was the most expensive treatment over the course of 5 years because of repeat treatments. At the same time, there's this cumulative complication rate. So if every time that you're treated and retreated, there's a risk of having a complication. And the difficulty with open surgery is that there's a high complication rate, relatively high, each time you operate. And so if you have to have two procedures in 5 years, that's double the complication rate or the likelihood of having a permanent complication. So that also has to be figured in. There's really not a perfect balance. It's really a matter of choosing your risk of complications and your comfort with dealing with that risk versus the ordeal of the procedure and the cost for the procedure.
So with that in mind, all those risks, what are your thoughts on conservative management? Because over the course of my practice as a therapist, it's virtually been told to us as practicing clinicians, orthotics and treatment by therapy is of no use whatsoever. And I know that there is a study fairly recent in 2017, which we'll include in the information sheet that we'll have available for all our listeners afterwards, that showed that orthotics is a very possible treatment method for as a conservative treatment method. So I was curious to know what your thoughts are with regards to that.
It's a very interesting topic, and it's not just that. It's the zillion-dollar question. How do you avoid the need to have sharp things in your hand to treat your Dupuytren? And the holy grail would be some kind of preventive treatment or some type of way to straighten out fingers without having to go through an invasive procedure, because even a minimally invasive procedure is invasive. And the experience with this is mixed. And so I'm going to go through a couple little data nuggets. So one fact is that most surgeons in the States, after they've performed a fasciectomy, open surgery, will refer a patient for not just for therapy, but for splinting, for a period of time after surgery. And there's no fixed numbers on that, but typically it's in the range of 4 to 12 weeks of either continuous splinting or an initial period of continuous splinting followed by a longer period of nighttime splinting. That's varies regionally. In Europe, it's not as common to splint routinely. And the difficulty with it has been lack of data. So at this point, there are 5 different studies that have looked at the efficacy and the added benefit of splinting routinely after open surgery for Dupuytren. And all of these studies have failed to show any added benefit in terms of long-term outcomes. And splinting for a prolonged period of time can increase the risk of losing the ability to bend the fingers, losing flexion. And so it's not an intrinsically completely benign intervention. So looking at that, that really goes against what I think anybody who deals with Dupuytren would think of, that splinting wouldn't be effective. Now, this is a specific situation. This is after open surgery for Dupuytren in which the biology has been challenged and is potentially ramped up. And so it's a difficult thing to guess how well people should do with splinting. But there is another data nugget, which is this paper that you referred to, a 2017 paper. It was originally presented at the 2015 International Congress on Dupuytren Disease in the Netherlands. And what this group did was to compare a almost continuous splinting, 20 hours a day, of either a palm splint or a splint on the back of the hand, to see whether this could straighten out fingers that had developed contractures from Dupuytren. And what they found was that in this relatively small study, that they were able to straighten out fingers that, to some degree, that had established fixed Dupuytren contractures. And this is not out of a vacuum. There have been other people that have reported this type of finding, but without having a well-done scientific study to document it. So, for example, there's a German hand surgeon, Albrecht Meinl, who has a lot of experience with percutaneous fasciotomy, and he has for over a decade been promoting the idea of having continuous splinting after a needle procedure to straighten out joints further than the needle procedure was able to straighten them out. And he has a number of impressive anecdotal stories of with pictures of people whose fingers really were straightened out considerably. But he's not published any kind of prospective or randomized study on it. But this study is. Now, about this study, a couple different things. excuse me. There was not a power analysis to see how large the study really had to be to get statistically significant numbers on this. So that's one difficulty. The other is that there's no follow-up. The study duration was only until people finished splinting. So that's a real unknown. What we do know is another data nugget, which is the experience that was developed from developing skeletal traction for Dupuytren, which in the States has evolved to the most common device is the digit widget. So this is a program of slowly stretching out fingers in order to undo contractures and to make surgery safer when it is done. The people that pioneered this were the Messinas in the 1990s, who had a large external fixation device that they used to simply pull on bent fingers to straighten them out. And what this did was to, over the course of weeks, fixed contractures could be straightened partially or sometimes completely. And when they did this, initially they thought, great, we've cured Dupuytren. But as they followed through on this, over half of the people that were treated this way had a recurrence of their contracture over the course of weeks once they stopped this continuous pulling on the finger. And so they modified their recommendations for people that had severe contractures. If somebody has a contracture that's 170 degrees, it's dangerous to operate because you can't see what you're doing. You're operating at the bottom of a hole. And so just stretching the fingers out to make the field more visible makes the surgery safer. And the recommendation was to stretch fingers out with some type of device that's attached to the skeleton that pulls the joints slowly straight, and then go in and do a fasciectomy to clean out the Dupuytren. And that has the best long-term outcome of treating severe contractures. So knowing this, let's circle back to this paper on splinting. The problem is that based on the Messina's experience, even if you stretch the fingers out, splinting 20 hours a day, if you stop that altogether, you'd have probably a high likelihood of losing the gains that you'd made. And so you might say, well, what about if we splint at night? We splint intermittently during the day. And what's the data that we have on this? Well, there's not any good clinical data on it, but what we know about how what happens at a cellular level with Dupuytren disease is that the way that contractures develop is through these special cells called myofibroblasts. And myofibroblasts are specialized cells that can grab the tissue and pull it, can grab the extracellular matrix and these little collagen threads that are inside our body and pull them together. And the way it works, it involves two types of contraction. And this is important. So there's one type of contraction, which is called periodic contractions. And these are weak contractions that the cell can pull a little bit, and it can move loose strands of collagen that are attached to the surface of the cell. It can move those around a little bit, but they're fairly weak. And they happen all the time, around the clock, every 100 seconds. So every minute or two, there's a little pull of these surface areas where collagen is attached to the surface of the cell. And occasionally, if you have a loop of collagen, two areas where collagen is attached to the cell surface will pull together and touch. And when that happens, there's a loop of extra collagen that's made, and there are enzymes that are circulating around the cells that are actually made by these myofibroblast cells that will trim off these loops where the collagen has been pleated and join the two ends together shortening a little tiny collagen thread. So that happens around the clock. Now there's another type of contraction, which is called an isometric contraction, which are not as common. They are 1,000 times stronger than these little periodic contractions, and they're strong enough for the cell to actually grab onto the extracellular matrix and pull it and deform it and cause loose strands of collagen. And so it's, those contractions last for hours. So while they're going on, then you have these loose collagen strands that that the little periodic contraction sometimes will pull together and trim out excess length. And those two work in lockstep. They sort of ratchet wounds closed, because this is part of how our bodies heal open wounds, is the you have this strong contraction that pulls on everything. And then while it's doing its work, then these little contractions actually pleat and trim individual collagen threads. So I know this sounds like it's way off topic, but let's go back to splinting. So if you're going to splint, then ideally you'd have to splint just continuously, because every minute or two you're having this setup that the myofibroblasts can shorten the collagen strands. And it's just shortening the collagen is what produces these cords in the palm. And anytime that your fingers are relaxed, the collagen in the palm is lax. And if you have these myofibroblasts in the palm that are just pleating little loose threads, and the hand is relaxed as it is while you sleep, then you may have some shortening. So in theory, you'd have to keep your hand splinted, your joint splinted in extension, pretty much around the clock to prevent that from happening. And
so when you were speaking about that, that occurs in wounding with the two different dances basically going on from the two types of contractions, that's a right. normal wounding process.
Right.
So in a Dupuytren's patient, even without a wound, they're just like Dupuytren's, here we go. That activity is always going on regardless. So right. it's like a constant wound. A Dupuytren's right. disease pathology is like a constant wound.
It's a constant, very much so, with some differences. So the strong contractions are believed to be triggered by pulling on the myofibroblasts. So that's the logic behind avoiding beating up your hands if you have collagen, if you have Dupuytren, because the mechanical forces on the palm, they actually trigger these strong contractions in the little myofibroblast cells. The other thing is that the cells that these myofibroblast cells make collagenase, and so that's why if you're pulling on the tissue very slowly, not enough to trigger a strong contraction, but enough to take the slack out of the collagen, then the enzymes that dissolve collagen may actually weaken it in areas and allow it to open up further. So it works both ways. That's the mechanics of how splinting continuously might stretch the fingers out.
And that makes sense, because they specifically stated in that article the importance of not over aggressively splinting them, basically, that if you are aggressive in your splinting nature, then you're going to have a reverse effect, just right. like you would in your therapy. And, you know, many therapists do think, oh, we got to pull these people so hard. And right. in fact, that's causing more harm than good.
Exactly. This is Roz Evans has published an article or two on that. And the most important take home that I think from her work was that people that were aggressively splinted, people that had, she compared having a palm splint that would, a traditional palm or extension splint versus a dorsal splint with active extension of the fingers to a straight position, and found that people that had the traditional palm splinting with a little bit tight, not only had more complications, but they didn't have as good final results when all the dust settled, because I think it provoked more inflammation.
Which does go back to just therapists in general sometimes have the idea of the no pain, no gain. And yeah. we know from being many years in the field, both of us, that the ones that are overtreated oftentimes do very poorly. And even patients themselves, they think the more the better, and then they overtreat themselves. So when they have wounds or any type of active changes in their tissues, we have to remember as therapists the fine line about treatment and overtreatment and being too aggressive.
Yeah, the finger is not a knee.
Right.
So, and that is true. And that's true also for the skeletal traction with the digit widget people that want to move on a little faster. They'll put an extra rubber band on to pull the tension a little bit a little bit greater. And they're the ones who have more inflammation, increases the risk of having infection and irritation that limits the amount of time the device can be on the finger. So, the other thing about wound healing that is different that relates to this paper is that the paper that you mentioned was comparing what they call compression orthoses. So these were not specific to push the finger straight. They were just to have some pressure on the wound. And the background of that is that light pressure and light continuous contact has been shown to flatten out hypertrophic scars and keloid scars, even to a certain extent. The reason that I mention this is that biologically, hypertrophic scars and keloid scars are different than Dupuytren scars and Dupuytren tissue. And the measurable difference is in type 3 collagen. Dupuytren is known for having high levels of type 3 collagen, particularly in the early active phases. Type 3 collagen is an immature type of collagen that is produced in early wound healing, but is ultimately removed. So hypertrophic scars and keloid scars actually have normal levels of type 3 collagen, which means that they are very different than whatever's going on in Dupuytren biology. So this might be why having continuous pressure or taping on Dupuytren itself might not be as effective as it is on a routine inflamed incisional scar. So interesting.
Yeah, really interesting. And a little bit with regards to the different levels of Dupuytren with versus MP versus PIP, I know there's significant treatment parameters that change. Could you touch on that just a little bit?
Sure. Thanks. That's an excellent question. So the MP joint and the PIP joint mechanically are very different. The shapes of the joints are different. The location of the ligaments are different. And the reaction to prolonged immobilization is different. We know just from treating other hand conditions that you can splint the MP joints in flexion for long periods of time and not have much risk of precipitating a flexion contracture of those joints. And that's just because the structures that hold the joint are not prone to shrinking in a way that limits the later joint motion. PIP joint is very different. If you splint the PIP joint in flexion for a prolonged period of time, you're very likely to provoke a permanent loss of extension of that joint. So that's a baseline without Dupuytren. The joint capsule on either of those joints is not directly affected by the Dupuytren biology. So when someone has a PIP problem from a prolonged Dupuytren contracture, it's not a direct effect of the disease, it's an indirect effect of the positioning. So over time, the volar plate of the PIP joint tends to shrink, the accessory collateral ligaments shrink, the extensor mechanism, particularly over the PIP joint dorsum, will stretch out or worse, and the consequence of this is that even fairly severe isolated MP contractures have a pretty good chance of having a complete correction and staying that way, whereas isolated contractures of the PIP joint are likely to have incomplete correction if they're past a certain degree of contracture. So the one of the breakpoints is around 40 degrees. That's been used in the XIAFLEX literature to identify being at low risk or high risk for an early recontracture after treatment. There's a study by Paul Smith and found that 4 out of 5 PIP joints that were 60 degrees or greater, 4 out of 5 of those joints had some damage to their extensor mechanism. And so the window to get the best result for the PIP joint is certainly before 60 degrees and ideally before 40 degrees. And
right. Otherwise, you have to treat the consequences that occurred with the PIP joint and the extensor mechanism.
Right. And we don't have good answers for that. So when somebody has a fixed joint capsule contracture, we know that going in and cutting the capsule is not a reliable way to get a good result. And it can have complications as well that are unintended. And part of the problem with the PIP joint has to do just with the mechanics of Dupuytren's disease, and can explain why the small finger PIP is the worst of all. So we know that we measure angular contracture in Dupuytren's disease, but Dupuytren actually causes linear contracture. Dupuytren doesn't bend the joints, it just shortens tissue on the front of the joint. I made up a virtual model to see the effect of the shortening of cords in different locations and how much angular contracture they would cause. And just from straight geometry, if you shorten, if you have an angle and you shorten the length that's on the opposite side of the angle somewhat, if you move in closer to the axis of the joint, that same amount of shortening will cause more angular contracture than if the cord or the third limb of the triangle is further away from the axis of rotation. So the further away the cord is from the middle of the joint, the less bend it produces. Now, bringing this back to the hand, the metacarpophalangeal joints are larger than the PIP joints, and so MP cords are, by their anatomic nature, going to cause less of a contracture than PIP cords. Because lateral cords are more dorsal, they're closer to the joint axis, lateral cords produce more angular contracture than central cords. And bringing this back to the small finger, lateral cords are more common at the PIP joint than at the MP joint. And lateral cords are more common in the small finger because of the abductor digiti minimi anatomy. And the small finger joint is smaller, just more compact than all of the other PIP joints. And so the same amount of shortening, just a few millimeters of shortening at the small finger PIP joint will cause a greater degree of bend of that joint than it would at any of the other joints. So that's why it's a dog. There's nothing magical about it. It's just there's this confluence of bad anatomy on the small finger PIP.
Yeah, that makes sense. Thanks for clarifying that. You always just think, oh, that PIP is a problem. But now we understand specifically why it's a problem, and especially the little finger.
Right, because it's small.
It has no chance. So let me ask you before we wrap up, there's this TV commercial that I keep hearing about from patients and from, I don't have a TV, so I haven't seen it, but they keep saying, what about this factsonhand.com? Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because when I did go to their site, it does kind of look like it has some information about Dupuytren's and being public awareness. So what's going on with that?
Well, the first thing is, I think that anything that raises awareness to the general public about Dupuytren's disease is good. Now, this Facts on Hand site is a public outreach educational site that's sponsored by Endo Pharmaceuticals as part of an unbranded marketing campaign for Xiaflex. So campaign doesn't mention that drug by name, but it's clearly reaching out to people with Dupuytren, and it has links that do link back to the drug company. And it's, I think, a reasonable step for that company to pursue to raise awareness about Dupuytren's disease. And anything that does that, I'm all for. because if I had a nickel for every time somebody said, what is that? I've never heard of that before. Then we could pay for this research today.
Yeah, that too, along with people that come in and they're like, why is my hand bent? Or so it's wonderful that we had this opportunity to spend time with you to learn a lot about Dupuytren's and your goal of finding the cure of this crippling disease. So with that in mind, let's wrap up with how therapists can be a part of this cure and what you envision for this year, next year, 5 years from now, and so forth.
That's a great question. And therapists are critical for dealing with people with Dupuytren on a lot of different ways. One of the big problems with Dupuytren is that patients have a lot of questions. They have a lot of issues that they commonly don't feel are addressed when they go see a surgeon. Depends on the surgeon's style, but it's not uncommon for a patient with Dupuytren who has a lot of questions to be handed a brochure and told to read it and that's it, and come back when they have a finger that needs to be treated. And so there's this bad disconnect that the patients feel of not being in control of their lives, not having any real control of their disease, despite being interested and aware. And that is something that hand therapists, I think, see a lot more than surgeons do, because particularly when someone's recovering from a procedure, they spend a lot of time because it's requires a lot of fiddling after treatment. And so I think that one option is, since hand therapists are on the front line of dealing with a lot of people with Dupuytren, they see people with Dupuytren even if they're not seeing them for that diagnosis, is to guide patients to seek qualified specialty care. And I'm probably preaching to the choir, but it's important that somebody with Dupuytren go to a board certified hand surgery specialist who's gotten specialty training, fellowship trained hand surgeon, because Dupuytren is difficult. And there are some docs who were exposed to hand surgery in their training, but that doesn't really prepare you for dealing with the really difficult surgical changes that Dupuytren disease causes. And so some people get in over their heads. And so it's important that, if possible, that a person be seen by a board certified hand surgery specialist. Another thing is to explain to patients the window of opportunity. And a lot of folks won't be bothered by Dupuytren from a functional point of view. If they have a small bend in their finger, they particularly an isolated PIP bend that is accompanied by a lax MCP joint. And so people can compensate by hyperextending their MP joint.
Right.
And the problem is, once that gets to a point that it really is a problem, they may be well past the 60 degree mark. So I think the drumbeat would be to say the best results are when a joint is treated when it's between 20 and 40 degrees. If you have the opportunity to be treated in that time, that's really the window to get the best results. The other thing is to support Dupuytren research and to refer patients to Dupuytren's.org and to refer all Dupuytren patients to enroll in the free research study at linked through dupestudy.com.
And with the dupestudy.com, as we discussed in briefly, everybody should put their information in there because you do need controls.
Right. We need controls. We need people with and without Dupuytren disease. And we need people at all stages of Dupuytren, even people that haven't seen a doctor. I mean, even particular people that haven't seen a doctor, it's unclear how many people are out there who have Dupuytren who haven't seen a doctor because they think it's arthritis or they've been misdiagnosed as having some other condition. Or they have a relative who had a bad experience with surgery for Dupuytren and they know what it is and they're not going to see the doctor. They can still sign up for the study so that we can get more information about what the real impact of the disease is, because it really flies under the radar. So our timeline for progress is, we have got people enrolled in the International Dupuytren Data Bank. We have hit our first funding benchmark to be able to begin the blood testing. We still need to do fundraising to do the analysis of the blood testing, and that's a significant amount, because it's very complex data. We have to have a data scientist working on that. But I expect within, by this time next year, that we will have our preliminary data, some of our preliminary analysis of what factors are abnormal in this preliminary, this pilot study of Dupuytren disease, and potentially what drugs seem to be good matches for that. And so that's what I'm hoping in 1 year. And then we'll have to go back to the National Institutes of Health, use that data to say, here is some preliminary data. We need to fund a larger version of this study. I would expect in 5 years to be well on the way with a larger version of this study. I would expect there to be some progress in cell culture and animal model models of Dupuytren biology, doing early testing of some of the medicines that are identified from the pilot study as potential Dupuytren therapeutics. And I would expect in 10 years that we'd be at the point of having human trials underway. I think that's a reasonable thing. My personal timeline is, I have Dupuytren. My late wife's father had terrible Dupuytren. I have four boys. They have Dupuytren in both of their parental lines, which means that they are at high risk, not just for more aggressive disease, but for early onset of disease, which correlates with more aggressive disease. So I have to have a medicine out. My calculations are in 15 years before my oldest is likely to show his first signs. So the push is on, and I got skin in the game.
Thank you for spending your time with us. And we will definitely put the push out there to get more people on the site and registered on, you know, for your newsletters, which I always enjoy, so that people can become more aware, because like you said, awareness is the key, even if we have to go through the drug companies.
Right. Whatever. It's a problem we have to find the answer for, and awareness is the first step. So, well, thank you very much for this. This is a great opportunity, and always good talking with you.
Thank you. And everybody can email info@handtherapy.com, and I will include as many of the articles and information that we discussed as I can. Thanks again.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Hand Therapy Heroes. Please subscribe and leave a 5-star review. Visit handtherapy.com and register for our newsletter containing free content and courses about our fascinating hands. Hold hands today for a more functional tomorrow.